Morning. Thank you very much. Is this coming all right? My brother is doing the sound, so if anything goes wrong, I'm going to know it's a prank. It's really great. It's so good to be here. It's been a bit last minute for me. Joel was actually... I've got a funny relationship with Joel because he endorsed that book, which is very sweet of him. He wrote on the back that it was like sucking in lungfuls of mountain air. And his brother then pointed out that mountain air has actually got almost no oxygen in it. It makes you feel a bit sick. And I hadn't noticed it for a couple of years. I thought it was quite quite funny. It's really good to be here this morning. And I love coming here. I've only been here a couple of times before and know lots of you already. Love hearing the notices. Love hearing Phil go, "Do you agree?" "Yeah, I agree with what I've just said." I always enjoy that kind of thing. And sitting there just sort of enjoying this. You know what I mean? You sort of want to rouse people. There's a lot of things that you do when you lead a church and do notices that you just don't really stop and think about sometimes, and then you realize they sound funny. The other one is leaving sealed bottles of water for the speaker on the stage, which you have to disrupt your talk enormously to open it, drink it. You then feel very self-conscious about swallowing it. I don't know. Anyway, I'm going to put that on the floor and won't go anywhere near it until an hour's time or something like that. Thanks very much. There's just lots of fun things about coming here. I'm told I've been asked to stand in for Michael because I'm the only person who talks nearly as fast as he does. Have you heard Michael speak before? Yeah, he's warp speed. He's faster than me, definitely. It's like Andrew Wilson on E, I think. It just sort of just goes much, much faster. I've come across, but I'm really, really excited about it, but feeling a little bit overwhelmed as well because I only knew yesterday. So I wanted to do a couple of things that were... about to do with apologetics, to do with answering questions that people have, and actually asking questions that I think we as Christians is good to ask. And so for a lot of people here, this may be the first time you've been in a meeting like this, or it may be you've been along a few times, but you're certainly not persuaded up here of the truth of a lot of the stuff that people have been singing. And you may, as you listen to the stuff, think, well, you know, it's all very well, but I'm just not sure it's true. I think it sounds nice, but I'm not sure whether it's true or not. And so I wanted to be able to come and actually ask a question, because I think it's good to do that sometimes. And I think it's valuable to have good answers to other people's questions. But what I wanted to do this morning was to start by actually asking a question, which I think everybody on the planet needs to have some sort of answer to, which will make sense a little bit of people's understandings of the way the world is. And the question is quite a simple one, I suppose, to be able to frame and to understand what it is. But I want to ask the question and call the talk this, and we'll show a DVD later on, which will bring some of the things together and maybe take some questions on it as well. But the question is, how did we get here? How did we get here? I want you to just think about it. How the human race, how the planet, how the galaxy, how it is that we are here. And because I think everybody on the earth has to have an answer to that question. And if you don't, and you never thought about it, then I think there's kind of a gap in thinking that we need to resolve and go, right, well, what are the options? How did we get here? So once upon a time, there wasn't a universe like this, and there is now. How did that happen? How did it end up forming planets, galaxies, people like you and me? That's what I want to ask, and I want to suggest to you that although the question is quite straightforward, I think actually there's only three answers that can ever be given to that question. In fact, of all of the things I've read about it, and there's been a fair few of those, I've come away concluding that only three different answers to that question, how do we get here, have ever been given. And some people, there'll be different levels to some of those three, and people will argue between themselves about which one it is. But it's a question that I've asked myself. It's a question that I'd like to ask you. It's like, how did we get here? If you just look at the fact that we're here, and there's oxygen, and there's a world with puffins and muffins and badgers and lions and planets and stars and you, how on earth is that true? How did that take place? So I want to assume for the moment, and I want to do something you don't normally do in church. I'm not going to quote the Bible at all, unless it happens to be relevant in the questions. I'm not going to speak from the Bible because I want to assume for a minute that you don't believe the Bible, because most people in Britain don't. And a lot of people in Britain have never read it. And I don't even want to assume that there's a God, which might sound strange because we've all just been singing to him, which has been a colossal waste of time if he isn't there. But just to understand that actually a lot of people don't believe that yet. A lot of people in this city don't believe that there's a God. They don't believe that the Bible is true. So for me to stand here and tell you that there's a creator God and the way we got here is because of God creating it, is a little, although I think it may still be true, it's not a very helpful way of helping you engage with people and of asking questions of those who aren't yet followers of Jesus. Well, what do you think? Because if I start quoting the Bible, you say, but I don't believe the Bible, so I'm back to square one. So I'm just saying, given the fact that we don't know if there's a God for a minute, and we don't know if the Bible's true or not, and assume that it isn't, then let's just start with that question, how did we get here based on what we know of the world? Let's just stand and look at the world around us and study research and study science and study the sky and study the animals and everything. And how come there is now a universe with stars and trees and planets and puffins? I like puffins. I don't know why. They often get mentioned. The most animal I most commonly refer to in my speaking. They're just something of the comedy and yet beauty of a puffin. But how did a puffin get? How did you get here? How did stars and galaxies come here? And if you ask that question to most scientifically literate people in Britain today, they will say something like, well, 4.5 billion years ago, the Earth formed as a result of a cosmic explosion that took place 13 billion years ago. And then life formed through a kind of accident, and then evolution took over, and we ended up with complex life like we do now. Right? So 13 billion years ago, bang, nothing happened for 9 billion years, and then life began, and it's gradually got more and more complex and formed complex creatures like you and me. And for the sake of this week, I'm going to say, let's just put a pin in that and say, let's say that's true. Okay, let's say that's exactly what happened. Because there's Christians who say, no, that's total nonsense, and there's Christians who say, yes, that's exactly what happened. But let's say for a minute that it's true. Let's say that there was a big bang and that evolution happened. Just, I'll give you that one for a minute. And then let me ask you, how did the big bang come about? And how did galaxies and stars and planets and a place where people like you and me could live develop from that explosion? Okay, that's what we're saying for the sake of today. And you may not believe that the big bang happened, in which case you're fine. And some of you will go, I'm not sure, I don't know why, I don't believe any of this stuff, I just take it from the Bible. But let's say for a minute that you think, huge explosion, and then billions of years pass in the darkness, and then life, and then evolution. What caused the Big Bang to form the things that we see around us today? What caused puffins from the Big Bang? What caused all of those other things? Most people probably never even thought about it. So most people I talk to, if they're not believers in Jesus, I will say to them, how did we get here? And they say, well, there was a Big Bang, and there was evolution. I say, all right, well, let's say for a minute that's true. And they're very surprised. They always think, what? You don't believe that? You're a God person, aren't you? I say, well, no, okay, let's just say it's true for the minute. So how did we get planets? How do we get stars? And most people, I don't think, are even particularly aware that that was an issue, because the whole point is that once upon a time there wasn't a universe like this, and now there is. Now, you guys might be thinking, this sounds a bit sciencey. It is a bit sciencey for now. There wasn't a universe once, and now there is. Big scientific statement. People used not to believe that, actually. I found this story quite interesting. So in the early part of the 20th century, the main view of cosmologists and scientists was that the universe was always here, and there was a steady state universe. And then there was a Catholic priest who was also an astronomer and a genius called Georges Lemaître, who came up with a theory called the cosmic egg theory, which I think is really cool. I have a little, this is my little equivalent of a cosmic egg. And Georges Lemaître came up with a theory and said, actually what happened was there was this very densely packed bit at the beginning of time which exploded and caused all of this stuff. And Albert Einstein, you know, the guy who plugged himself into the mains and Albert Einstein said, that's a load of rubbish. And Georges Lemaître said, Einstein doesn't know anything about physics, which I think is a little harsh for those of you who've known some of Albert Einstein's writings. And they had this debate, right? And Georges Lemaître, in the scientific community, won the debate. So that 20 or 30 years later, I'm very sad that we no longer call it the cosmic egg, because in the 1950s, a guy called Fred was on the radio and was making fun of the idea and said how silly it was and called it the Big Bang Theory and said, what a stupid idea, a Big Bang? And so now we call it that because the term caught on. And 8 years after that, the scientific community said, we found what we regard as basically being proof that that's true. Again, whether or not you believe that. They used to believe that there was a permanent universe, but now the almost entire scientific community believes, no, there isn't a permanent universe. The universe had a beginning. There used not to be a world like this, and now there is. So I want to ask the question, how did we get here? You with me? Yes, some blank faces. That's all right. Okay. And when you stop and think about that question, there's only three possible answers that you can give to that question. Okay, here they are. One, luck. Two, a multiverse. Ooh, scary word. Three, a creator. You can read books by anybody in the world, and one version of one of those three theories will be what people tell you has happened. Either there is luck, and basically there was an explosion, and it might have formed dozens of things, or billions of things, and it didn't. It happened to form a universe with Puffins and me, and you. Or there is a multiverse, which is a big word, but I'll explain what it is, but it's basically there's billions and trillions of different universes out there, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And the third one is that there is a creator of some sort. Doesn't prove it's the God of the Bible, doesn't prove it's any particular God, anything about him, but it just says those are the only three options. Either somebody made it, or there's billions of universes, or we're just very, very lucky. So I'm going to start with the first one. And I'm just going to ask you how you answer that question. Okay, you probably know how I answer the question because I'm preaching on a Sunday morning. But I want to ask you the question. How did we get here? Which one of those three do you find persuasive? And the first answer that I think most people in Britain would give if you stopped and asked them was, it's really an issue of luck. It's really an issue of blind chance. If you stop people in the street, they might not have thought about it. But you said, how did it happen? They just, well, it just did. You know, there was a bang, and I know it might have formed something else, but it did, and here we are. We're a lucky accident, basically. But here's the thing. So for our universe to be possible, this is, hardcore science bit for a minute. Some of you guys already know all this, but some of you are going, this is not normal for a Sunday morning. But I just want you to hold me with me for a second. So for our universe to be possible as it is, requires at least 15 different numbers to be exactly what they are. 15 different numbers. When I say a number, I mean, the scientists would call it a constant. But I'm going to call it a number because that's kind of, I guess, an easier way of understanding it. And these are independent physical kind of laws that have to be what they are for a life to be possible, okay? So if gravity was slightly greater or slightly weaker, there would be no planets. So the force of gravity in our universe has to be exactly what it is, to about one part in a million for there to be such a thing as a planet, right? Not a person or a puffin, but a planet. Okay, so if gravity changed, if the nuclear force, right? There's two different nuclear constants called the strong and the weak. And the strong nuclear constant has to be exactly what it is or there's no life. And there's not just life, again, no planets. If the weak one isn't, then there's, again, no life. So look at this quote here from Francis Collins. When you look, this is the guy who directed the Human Genome Project until about 2 years ago, which means he knows more about science than pretty confidently anybody in the room. But he said, when you look from the perspective of a scientist at the universe, it looks as if it knew we were coming. There are 15 constants that have precise values. If any one of those constants was off by even one part in a million, or in some cases by one part in a million million, the universe couldn't actually have come to the point where we see it. Matter wouldn't have been able to coalesce. There wouldn't have been no galaxy, stars, planets, or people. Okay? Egghead Bright Man says 15 different things have to be exactly what they are for there to be such a thing as a universe as it is. If our universe had expanded at a slightly different rate, then there would be no planets. There'd be no galaxies. Now, you might not care about that. You just think, well, that's okay. That's just the way it's come about. But I'm saying to you, if that's just a matter of luck, if all 15 of those numbers, one at a time as you go down the line, every single one of them needs to be right to one part in a million, that's a lot of luck. I want to put it to you, okay? And I'll try and illustrate why I would put it that way. So I want you to imagine that you guys don't do this because you're a good church, right? But let's say that there's a scallywag in here who loves playing roulette. Anybody play roulette? Anyone going to own up? Okay, roulette. Yes, thank you, man at the back. There's something about the techies. You never trust them, do you? They're going to cut me off in a minute. But Matt, you've got a big, let's say you play roulette and I want you to imagine there's a roulette wheel here with a million numbers on it, okay? I want you to imagine that the universe is a result of luck. Okay? Now, there's a roulette wheel here with a million different numbers on it. And these million numbers represent the different values that gravity could have in the universe. Okay? And you come up to this roulette wheel, and you grab it by the lever, and you swing it round, and it goes... And you go, wow, it's landed on exactly the right value that is required for our universe to exist and for there to be planets. Wow, that's amazing. All right, that's quite lucky. On we go. And you swing in the next one. And this next one has got a million numbers on it. And it's unrelated to the first one because they're independent variables. So the second one has just got a million numbers on it. And that's all the different values that, let's say, the strong nuclear force could have. And you swing it one, it goes, and you go, have we got it again? Can't believe it. This one's right, and this one's right. And you go along to the third one, and you swing it, and it goes, and lands on exactly the right one out of a million. And you're beginning to think, there's something a bit strange going on here. This is very, very lucky. I can't believe I'm winning each time. And you move along 14 different wheels. Wheel number 15 has got a lot more than a million numbers on it. Wheel number 15 represents the cosmological constant, and you don't know what that is, and you don't care, but it's a number that is very unlikely to be what it is. And it's got 10 to the power 60 noughts on it. Okay, so there's kind of million, 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 lots and lots of numbers, right? More numbers that you can kind of imagine. And you've got the 14 wheels, and they're all right. And you're thinking, we're going to get a universe. I don't believe it. It's going to exist out of blind luck. This is astonishing. And you come along to the final one, and you swing it, and it goes, and you go, yes, and then it goes, and you go, no, the universe has been destroyed. One of the numbers was one out, and now the whole thing's been lost, and it goes, and the whole of Brighton gets sucked into a vortex, and McDonald's is flying through the sky, disappearing from existence, and you're just staring in horror, thinking, there is no universe. So that, now that is the kind of luck we're talking about if we're saying, well, the universe just happened as a result of luck. In other words, the universe is incredibly finely tuned to allow planets, let alone life. John Polkinghorne, again, an egghead, fellow of the Royal Society, very bright man. He uses a word in here which made me laugh, because he basically says there are two types of people in the world, smart people and dumb people, and you're all dumb people. But we'll see how he does it in a minute. Okay? John is a brilliant man and a very humble man, so that's not what he meant, but it does sound a bit like it. He said, for us to be possible requires a balance between the effects of expansion and contraction, which at a very early epoch in the universe's history, called the Planck time, has to differ from equality by not more than, yeah, this always happens. The guy at the back, 10 to the power 60 is a different number from 1,060, okay? I've been stitched up by that before, and in fact, it happened in my book. I was quite embarrassed. It makes you look rather foolish. But, okay, anyway, not more than 1 in 10 to the power 60, which is a much bigger number, okay? So that's 1 with a million noughts after it. Sorry, 1 with 60 noughts after it, rather. Okay, so 1 million, 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 all the way through. So he's saying that this gap, this number has to be exactly what it is and can't differ from what it is by more than 1 in 10 with 59 noughts after it. Thank you very much, my friend. Very good. This is the dumb versus smart thing. The numerates will marvel at such a degree of accuracy. So if you're in the room marveling and sitting back on your chair going, I marvel at this amazing degree of accuracy, you, John Polkinghorne, would say, you are numerates and you should give yourself a round of applause. For the non-numerate, which is the rest of us. We don't understand maths. We don't know what 10 to the 60 is. I thought it was 1,060. I didn't even know. Well, you are non-numerate, John Polkinghorne says. But for the non-numerate, I'll borrow an illustration. I'll make it easy for you. He says, I'll borrow an illustration from Paul Davis of what the accuracy means. He points out that it's the same as aiming at a target an inch wide, the other side of the observable universe, 20,000 million light years away, and still hitting the mark. That's the level of accuracy for just one of those numbers, right? So let's say that's the last one. You're going to stand, okay, Brading, come here. Well, actually, don't come here. There's your egg. Okay, now this target is an inch wide. Can you go up to where Tim Jones is standing right at the back? Steve Boone's going to have to watch because there's a low-flying object heading over his head anytime now. So, Brading, you've got to hit, this is actually generous. This is more than an inch wide. Brading's going to try and hit this at the other side of the observable building, not the other side of the observable universe. But his guitar is right here, so he'd better be accurate, okay? Okay, let's go. Whoa! That actually wasn't that bad, but I want you to imagine that he was 20,000 million light years away. I think we'd think he'd struggle. I had to use the egg because at my church, we got somebody to do that and absolutely creamed some guy on the front row in the back of the head, and it really hurt him. He wasn't looking. He was just quite an angry South African guy in our church. And that's just one of the 15 numbers. Now, I'm doing this. I'm doing this because I want you to see that saying our universe is just as it is because of luck is a stretch. Okay, that is a lot of luck. Blind chance doesn't sound like it's good enough. It doesn't sound as if those roulette wheels just happened to land with it. They might have, but it's so exceptionally unlikely that I think to stake your worldview on it is risky. I think that you've got to ask questions about that. Now, that's why I asked the question, how did we get here? It sounds like something or someone is actually arranging those roulette wheels to be what they are. Stephen Hawking said this. It's going to come up on the next slide. The odds against a universe like ours emerging out of something like the Big Bang are enormous. I think there are clearly religious implications. Okay? You know, and Hawking, a number of times, says quite interesting things. He's not a believer. And actually, he sometimes gets quoted out of context to make it sound like he believes in God. I don't think he does. But what he's saying is, you've got to consider religious implications when you look at the sheer improbability of the universe coming out of something like the Big Bang. There'll be implications to that being true. And he's not going to speculate what they are, because that's not his job. But he just wants you to realize that you've got to stop and think if you go beyond it. That's what Stephen Hawking thinks. What about you? How'd you get here? So if it isn't luck, okay, I'm going to move on to the second. Maybe you think it is, right? But I want to question that and say, is that viable? If it isn't luck, what alternatives are there? The second option is that there's a multiverse, right? This is another option that's been gaining a lot of popularity in the academic community in the last 30 years. And this is the theory that there are billions of other universes out there, and they've all got different sorts of physical laws, and the one that we live in is the one that happens to have life in it, and all the others don't. So in other words, they're saying the roulette wheels do look ridiculous, but what if there were billions of universes with all sorts of different combinations of numbers? Then we might just live in the right one. Okay, so that's the explanation. I don't know if you've met anybody who thinks that. I've met a few. I found that most people haven't really thought about it. Again, if you stop people in the lanes and just said, what do you think? Not many of them will say multiverse, but some of them might. So I just want to think it through for a minute. And I don't know that many people have ever thought about it, but I want to say this. Is it possible that that's true? Yes, it is possible that there are billions of universes out there. Is it likely? Don't know. Let me ask you a different question. Is there any evidence for it at all? Hey? Is there any evidence that that is the way things are? Are we ever going to get a bit of information? Are we ever going to fly to a part of our universe with a telescope and look in and see another universe outside our own? Of course we aren't. Our universe, the whole point is if it's a universe, there's one, we are living within it. And actually all we would do is we'd find another universe beyond it. Or we'd actually say that's part of our universe. It's just bigger than we thought. But we're not going to find that our universe is here and then find evidence of another one over here. So it's a little bit like disproving the multiverse is a bit like disproving unicorns. It's actually quite hard to do. You have to go around and prove that there is no such thing and go, well, I've never seen one. No, you've never seen one either. What evidence is there that there isn't a multiverse? Well, it's kind of hard to work like that. What evidence is that there isn't a unicorn? But it's like Anthony Flew, who's an amazing philosopher who said he never believed in God for 50 years and argued against it for years, and then at the end of his life recently has changed his mind and said, actually, I think there is a God. And he said the multiverse theory is like a blunderbuss. It explains everything and nothing. It manages to explain lots and lots of things by making up billions of universes that we'll never know if they're there. I was a Red Dwarf fan. I don't know if any of you guys know Red Dwarf, but there's a character in Red Dwarf called Crichton, who's this mechanoid robot, and he's really kind of pedantic. And at one point, he tells one of the other characters that they've come up with a superlative theory except for two minor flaws. One, it doesn't have any evidence for it. And two, it doesn't have any evidence for it. Now, I know that technically speaking, that's only one minor flaw, but I thought it was such a big one, it was worth mentioning twice. And that's a little bit where I am on the multiverse. I just think, well, it is possible. It is theoretically possible. Now, somebody who believes in billions of universes might go, yeah, but you can't prove there's a God either. To which I would say, that is true, but I want to make two responses. And stand back and say, right, so luck sounds silly. You've got billions of other universes, or you've got a creator God. Those are the two options on the table at the moment. Both the believer in God and the believer in millions of universes both say, I'm explaining what is known, this world, by means of an unknown, which is stuff out there. And at one level, that's true, right? They're both doing the same thing. But there are two important responses to that idea. Firstly, when faced with astronomically unlikely things that have very fortunate results, we generally assume design before parallel universes. In normal life. Now, that doesn't prove that it's true in the universe. It might not be. I don't want to imply that I'm proving God here. I just want to say that's normally what happens. Okay, so Alvin Plantinga, who's a philosopher at Notre Dame University in America, he talks about the idea that if you're playing poker and the dealer deals himself 20 hands in a row of straight aces, you could say there's billions of hands of poker played in history, and at some point someone's going to get 20 hands of straight aces in a row. So maybe I'm just the unfortunate so-and-so who happened to bet my mortgage on him not getting it, and then he did. But most of the time, we wouldn't jump to that conclusion. We say that is theoretically possible, but we generally prefer the argument of design over the argument of university. You would say, no, the dealer is cheating, even if you thought he was a great guy. Even if you thought that, how would he do that in a casino? But he's managed to get 20 hands of straight aces. It looks more likely that he's cheated and designed the process than that it's just bad luck. And I think that's actually relatively common sense, right? John Leslie's another philosopher, Canadian guy, and he's written a whole book about the topic I'm talking about. It's a very interesting guy. And he imagines a man sentenced to death by firing squad. And he said, you've got 50 expert marksmen all lined up against the back wall, and they're all aiming and firing their weapons at him. And he goes, ready, aim, fire, bang. And he's got his blindfold on, and he hears the bang and doesn't die. And he waits for a few minutes and thinks, this is odd, I seem to still be here, is this death? Takes his blindfold off and realizes he's not dead. All of them missed. And at that point, John Leslie says, he can conclude one of three things. He can either say, well, it's a bit lucky. You know, they all missed. Sounds like it's just bad luck. All right, well, it's good luck for me, off for a drink. But he probably wouldn't do that. Or he could say, maybe there are billions of simultaneous executions taking place today. And I'm the lucky man who got missed. All the others, they would have died once upon a time. I mean, occasionally they're going to miss. I'm just the lucky guy, off for a drink. Or he would say, they've all missed. That doesn't sound like it's an accident. It doesn't sound like there's billions of other people out there having the same experience. Maybe they're bribed. Maybe they're drunk. Maybe my appeal papers came through at the last minute. Maybe some sort of design is behind the fact that this has happened to me. And I think in normal life, that's how we reason. And I can't prove that it's wrong, the multiverse theory. It's special pleading to me. It's just the only time we would use logic like that. And if you use logic like that in the rest of life, you'd get run over a lot, wouldn't you? Become very gullible. And the second response I would want to give is just briefly, William of Ockham. Anybody heard of Ockham's razor? Have you studied kind of philosophy, science? A lot of people would have heard of Ockham's razor. There was no razor. In fact, I don't think you even had razors like we do now back then. But he referred to the principle that you shouldn't multiply causes without necessity, which basically means if you could have one explanation or lots of different explanations for the same thing, you always choose the one which requires one explanation because it's less complex. And for me, the multiverse says there's billions of different causes of this thing rather than there's one. So for those two reasons, I'm thinking multiverse, I just don't find that intellectually persuasive. I can't prove it's impossible. I can't prove unicorns are impossible either. But what I can do is to say that doesn't sound like the kind of way in which we would reason in any other area of life, unless, I guess, we were almost desperate to avoid the conclusion that God had done it, or that some sort of creator was there. So luck, multiverse, the third one, creator. We're coming into land, okay? So the creator, the final explanation of the universe of the three, and the third answer to the question, how do we get here, is that there's someone who made it, that there is a creator God. Generally in life, when you find things which are fine-tuned and fit for purpose, you conclude somebody built them. Which is why I did not assume that this speaker happened to have become assembled by an explosion in the guitar and amp shop down the road. I don't assume that there's just loads of technical bits and pieces, and it just blew up and formed a speaker and a microphone and a keyboard. I don't normally reason that way. I normally would look at something like that and think it is fine-tuned and fit for purpose, and therefore it's probably been designed. That's generally, again, there's a bit of common sense kicking in there. That's just what we normally do. Now, you can believe that as well as believing in a Big Bang and evolution, if you want. Some of you will, some of you won't. But I just want to say, the Big Bang and evolution are not replacements for the case I'm making here at all. They're, in a way, attempts to articulate what might have happened next in some scientific perspectives. But the issue is, whatever you believe about how the universe came about, the belief in a creator seems to be necessary to explain, for me, it seems to be necessary to explain how it is that we've got something rather than nothing, how it is we've got planets rather than just an empty void. And so I would say that I think if you've got luck, multiverse, and creator, I generally would lean towards the creator one simply because that is what happens when we're faced with enormously improbable things in normal life that don't seem to have any other explanation other than that somebody built them. We generally say, well, maybe there's a designer then. And that's where I land, and that's where I've come out on it, and just sort of thinking, well, I can't prove it. That's actually not the only reason I believe in God. I believe in God for lots of reasons. But if nothing else, that one makes me think, I can't rule out stuff like the resurrection of Jesus because science says it's impossible. Because science doesn't say it's impossible. Science says, well, no. In order to have a world, we've got to have billions of universes or a creator, and we don't know which one it is. And in fact, when you look at it, you think, well, we might be leaning this way on the basis of the design argument. Now, none of this proves that God is the God of the Bible, the God revealed in Jesus of Nazareth, the God who, as we just sang before, the God who died for us, none of it proves who that God is or what they're like. We'll talk about a bit more about that in the second meeting and talk about the major obstacle that a lot of other people have, which is suffering, and talk about how that might lead us to the God of the Bible in some way. But it doesn't prove that. A lot of people might stand back and say, you know, I think there could be a creator, but I'm not sure it's the same as your God. And to be honest, in the 40 minutes we've had together, I can't go any further than I've gone now. But I just want to get you to think that a creator of some sort, it might be worth investigating what they're like. So Richard Dawkins, who's pretty famous and going on record for saying there is no God, actually said, you could convince me that there was a superhuman designer. I think that's possible, but I think it's nothing at all like the God of the Bible, right? So a superhuman designer of some sort is a possibility from his point of view. Some atheists are more specific about superhuman designers. So Francis Crick, who discovered with James Watson the double helix strand of DNA, the structure, Francis Crick said this: life on Earth may have begun when aliens from another planet sent a rocket ship containing spores to see the Earth. Okay? Now, this is about life, to be fair, not about the origin of the universe. But I just think some scientists can be very, very robust on scientific principles, and then suddenly aliens have entered the picture, and you think, whither the aliens? Where have they come from? So some people might do that. It might be aliens are responsible. It might be that there's a superhuman designer. It might be that there's an all-powerful God. Put differently, we have to choose between, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, aliens created the heavens and the earth, a superhuman designer created the heavens and the earth. But somewhere along the way, we may find ourselves thinking, I'd like to find out what, if anything, that God is like. I'd like to ask the question, if that is one of the three options, I know the next thing I've got to do is work out, well, who are they? How did they? What have they said about themselves? Have they done anything? Even Richard Dawkins, as I mentioned, he said in a debate in 2008, which I find quite an interesting quote, he said, you could persuade me that there was a creator who designed everything, but this is incompatible with a God who cares about your sin, what you do with your genitals, and what you think about. What he said is, I think creating a creator who designed stuff, I'm okay with that at one level, but I just don't like the idea that God might end up deciding whether I was allowed to do what I wanted. I don't like the idea of a God who tells me what to think or tells me how I should live. I like a God who can control my sex life and tell me this is okay, that's not. That's why I don't believe in God. I found that a very interesting quote. I don't know. I wouldn't have a problem with God if he didn't have a problem with sin. I just thought it was a challenge. Ultimately, questions like this aren't settled by science alone, okay? They're just settled by getting to a start. I'm effectively trying to clear the ground and say these are the only three ways of looking, as far as I've ever heard of, and then the questions come back to me on this and say, I think there's a fourth option you've missed. That's fine. Come back. I may have got it wrong, but I've done this a few times. I've never come across anybody who's heard of a different type of option. And then I'd want to go back and say, well, if the luck one doesn't work, and if the multiverse one just sounds like special pleading, do we need to investigate the possibility that there's a creator? Because if there is, we have to be prepared for anything. If there is, then miracles might well happen. God might well decide to do various things in the earth that we might find surprising. God might well choose to come down as a human being to rescue us, and he might well choose to rise from the dead to destroy the power of death. We can't prove that those things couldn't happen. If there's a God, he might want to give us jobs to do. He might have a mission for us or a purpose for us. He might want to fix suffering and injustice in the world. He might want to bless the world through the seed of Abraham and through the people of God. He might want to do all kinds of things. And we can't rule those things out if there's a creator. We've got to ask those questions and find out. Because if there is a God, we've got to ask a lot more questions. What's he like? Has he revealed himself? Has he said or done anything? Was Jesus God? And if so, what? Because if God really did create everything, then he's going to be very powerful, very awesome, very scary, and we're going to need some help in approaching him. It's interesting that if you look at the three major world religions who agree with the statement, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, they all agree exactly on what happened next as well. They all agree exactly on why evil entered the world, which we'll look at in the next meeting. So I want to invite you to ask yourself, how did we get here? How do you think we got here? What do you think? Luck? Multiverse? Creator? You persuaded? Interested? So what I'd like to do, what might be good to do, if you can do this at the back, is actually to run the DVD after we have the questions, because it might be a quite nice way of putting the whole thing together. Is that all right? Somebody wave and say, yeah, okay, that's great. So actually, if some questions have come through, obviously not the one about where babies come from. I know some of you bless you, 9 o'clock in the morning, you weren't expecting to see the word genitals on the screen, for which I kind of apologize. I know you're a little bit squeamish in Brighton. It just happened to be in the quote, so sorry about that. But if you have any questions of any kind, anything that you feel picks up on some of these themes you'd like to ask, then just text away and they'll hopefully come through. You were born into a Christian family, right? Do you really think you are swayable to other options? Didn't you come to all your studies with an agenda? Woo-hoo, that's a very good question. To be honest about that, I think you have to say how objective is anybody? Yeah, I think that's the question, isn't it? How are you really open to persuasion? Are there, if somebody was to come to you and say, I know you believe all that, but you only believe it because you've always believed it and you've just tried to claw your way through evidence, how would you ever change your mind? I think I've got to come and to be honest and say, yes, I think all of us come to our studies with some sort of agenda initially. And that actually what we don't do is start, and I don't think anyone does, start with a totally blank mind and then come to evidence as a neutral observer who then just makes conclusions about facts without any preconceived ideas about the way the world is. I don't think any of us do that. I certainly don't. I know I come to things, I was born in a Christian family. My parents, in the 10 days before they got married, my parents both became Christians separately from one another, which is kind of strange. And then my dad then didn't want to tell my mum, and it was all a bit awkward. But then they managed to get through it on honeymoon, I guess, and work out, oh, look, we're both Christians. That's lucky. And then they brought me and my brother who's up there and the other two, my sisters, they brought us up and said, we'll teach you about Christianity. We'll teach you about who God is. And I guess that for me, the big challenge, I was probably in some ways a fundamentalist, actually, as a kid, as a teenager. I probably didn't study evidence rigorously at all. I probably came with a set of assumptions, this is all true, and because it's all true, I'm right. And because I'm right, you're wrong, and because you're wrong, you need to change and sort your life out, otherwise you're going to go to hell. And I probably was like that until I was 18 or 19, and I went to university, and I was at Cambridge University, and I had a lot of friends who were very bright, and we used to stay up all night talking, and I was very much the duffer of the group. I just listen and try and follow the argument somewhere. And as I went on, I think every single person in the room had an agenda. All of us had, in some senses, perceptions about the way the world was, formed by what we'd read and what we'd seen on TV and scientific research we'd studied and what history we'd studied and our family background and our values. But what I found was the fact that you come with some preconceived ideas does not mean that you're not open to persuasion by evidence, because there's actually an awful lot of things in life about which I come with a preconceived idea and then discover that my preconceived idea is totally wrong. I imagine a lot of us have experienced what that's like. And that was true for a lot of other people there as well. And so although I personally have held something a bit like the belief I hold today for some years, what I found was that over time, I began to question and critique and then got to a very blank place where I just thought, I'm not sure if this is this even true. And actually for me, the thing that convinced me to... So I thought, yeah, I think this is true. I believe it because I know it's true because I'm a fundamentalist, really. And then I went, oh, goodness, is it all true? And at university, I was just wandering around a bit, sort of going, I think it is, but what about this and what about that and what about that? And actually, for me, it was when I was 24, reading a book about the resurrection of Jesus that just completely, an academic, big, weighty academic book on the resurrection that blew me away. And I thought, this is historically real. Like, this actually did happen. This is a better explanation for evidence than the alternatives. And so I've found that as I've gone on, I've found things when I've studied evidence, I've really tried to push to the end. And that's why I like doing questions, because I want to be honest. And if somebody might come up with an idea I'd never thought of, and I have to go, right, I have to think about this for a while then and see, you know, is this still true? But I think none of us come blank sheets of paper without any preconceived ideas. All of us come with some presuppositions, which then need to be challenged by studying things rigorously. And I've tried to do that. But whether or not I've succeeded in doing that, I mean, I hope you would see that the argument I've given this morning is trying to be based on evidence. It's not based on assumption that it's all true. So I hope, if anything, that speaks for itself. But I realize there may be more to the question than that. And it's really good to be honest about it, isn't it? Next one. Where did God come from? I said not the one where babies come from. So somebody said, where did God come from? I think there's a good form of this question, which is, it would be a widespread thing. You're saying that the universe is created, but if we go back and say, well, God created it, then don't we have to ask how God was created? And to be honest, I think at some point, it's usually the question's asked because people don't necessarily get the what the word God actually means, or they don't understand what I mean when I say the word God, or what I think probably most people here mean. So to say, for instance, why isn't a square a circle is something that you just sort of think, well, yeah, it could be if what square and circle meant were totally different from what they do. But as soon as you understand what the concept of squareness is, you understand that by definition it's not a circle. And I think the idea, the fact that God, you see, when I use the word God, I mean eternal being, omnipotent being, all-knowing being. So that, in terms of, by definition, that God hasn't come, that God has always been. Now, you might disagree that that kind of being could ever exist, but I'm saying that if you do believe that there is a God, then that God hasn't come from anywhere, because that's just not what the word means. So again, I spent a lot of time reading and engaging with Richard Dawkins in the last few years, and he does a chapter in his book. His book is called The God Delusion, and a number of people in the scientific community have actually written responses and said, really, this book should have been called The Created God Delusion, in the sense that, yeah, a God who's come from somewhere else and been created by another being is, of course, is a delusion. But in the sense of what the word God means, eternal, all-powerful being that's always been there, God is the beginning point. So basically, everybody in the world will either believe, really, in a pre-existent God or in a pre-existent gas, probably. Most people in the room, you have to pick between those two. Well, at one level, then the questions have to stop, don't they? So, well, where did it come from? And I would say that for me, because of the arguments I've outlined, I think the pre-existent God is a more compelling option. But a God that was created, I agree, is total nonsense. Next one. If they prove the multiverse theory, how would that affect your faith? That is a good question. I'm glad you asked me that. It sounds very Radio 4, doesn't it? The most recent academic treatment of the multiverse theory, which came out last year, I think, maybe 2008, has actually an awful lot of debate in it as to whether or not you can even call this scientific at all. And even if you just want to do a kind of, the Noddy's Guide and go on Wikipedia and just type in multiverse and read what they say about it, they'll just say, to be honest, the debate really isn't whether this is true or not, is whether or not you can even make scientific statements about it, because we are setting up at something that almost by definition is beyond the realms of investigation scientifically. So most philosophers and scientists are saying, even in the scientific text about the possibility of how other physical laws might vary, they're saying, but we're never going to know whether it will or not. It's not something that you can actually empirically test, because the whole point is that the universe is the realm of our observable worlds. And so you're almost saying, if they conduct a scientific experiment on something which is beyond the realm of scientific experiment, how would that affect your faith? I think, well, I don't think the if is ever going to happen. Having said that, I have read very interesting Christian explanations of the multiverse theory, which is a little bit weird. Here's one that I thought sounded so silly that I didn't really believe it, but I thought it was quite funny anyway. They said, actually, if there's an infinity of universes, which is one version of the multiverse theory, and for some, the only one that justifies the 15 roulette wheels, right, there would have to be an infinite number of universes, then in one of those infinite number of universes, Jesus must have risen from the dead. Which I thought was quite interesting. If there's an infinite number of universes, in one of them, Christianity's true. And if it's true in one, then it's true in them all. So I thought that was quite to be honest, the common sense test makes you go, that can't be right, surely. But this is kind of my point about the multiverse theory. But I think I've read theistic arguments explaining how belief in God and belief in the multiverse, I don't think it has to be one or the other, actually. I just don't think that the multiverse theory stands on its own merits. But I think it may well be that there are other universes. I wouldn't particularly be bothered if there were. It's a bit like when people say, if there was life on other planets, would you worry about it? I personally wouldn't very much. I'd be surprised, but I wouldn't freak out about it. So that's where I'm at. But I kind of thought, you almost want to follow it to the conclusion and then say, if we've got an infinite number of universes, then, you know, is Jesus king in one? And if he is, and if God is the creator of one, then isn't he the creator of all of them? So doesn't that prove the existence of God? To me, the common sense test, it fails, but logically, you can almost see how it could work. I've lost some of you. I visited countries where there are geographical formations like hanging valleys sitting on top of hanging valleys. I guess these take thousands and thousands of years to form. Does that mean planet Earth is thousands and thousands of years old, which maybe includes an ice age, etc.? Great question. Really good question. Okay, so thousands and thousands of years isn't a problem. I would want to make it state it more. I'd want to make the question worse before I make it easier, because thousands and thousands of years, the answer is, yeah, lots of formations take thousands of years, and according to the Bible, no matter how you read it, the Earth is certainly at least 6,000 to 10,000 years old, but some would say a lot older. And So thousands and thousands of years isn't an issue. But a lot of those rock formations you're talking about would have taken, in the judgment of the scientists, millions and millions of years. And so that presents more of a challenge if you believe that the Bible says the Earth was created 6,000 to 10,000 years ago. There's basically two ways of looking at it, and I'm going to sit on the fence a little bit, because one of the ways is to say that when God created the world, he created the world with the appearance of age. So when he created a human being, he created a human being as an adult rather than as a baby. And God created the world and there's trees, you could have chopped the trees in half and there would have been tree rings, which made it look older than it was. And some people would say he did that with everything. He did that with rocks, he did it with the whole world. That's one answer. The other answer is actually the type of writing that Genesis 1 represents is a more poetic expression of days, and that it's, you don't have to be 24-hour days if you don't want to, and as you stand back from it, it's more like a sweeping creation song, which is generally the view that I'm a bit more comfortable with, and that actually the writer isn't trying to tell us it happens like this, 24-hour days, but actually that it's a sweeping song describing how God created everything, and therefore the door is open for the universe to be very old, and if science then discovers that it is, then I'm fine with that. Now, you can take one of those two views and probably variants of both. But so for me, I would say the hanging formations are not a problem. I don't struggle with that at all. But certainly, I think everybody says planet Earth is thousands of years old, but some would disagree about whether it's millions of years old from a Christian perspective. And I think that, for some, that presents a challenge. So we have to think our way through what type of writing Genesis 1 is. I think that's a major issue. But then you may have taught into that as a church. I don't want to kind of press any further on that for the moment, but that's where I've done, well, that's where I'm at. Why doesn't God simply appear and tell everyone that he is God and make it easy for everyone? It's me! Yeah, that could happen. I think that one leads me very well onto, this is the last question, so it leads me very well onto the DVD which we're going to do, which finishes with almost exactly that question. So I'm really pleased that you've said that. Because I think, you see, what we've talked about today is the idea, it's almost been a bit abstract, hasn't it? It's almost been a God who is up there and has made the world, and we haven't looked at whether he's done, said, appeared, done anything else. But of course, that actually leads us straight on to, I think, the heart of the question, which is, if there is a God who's made the world, why doesn't he reveal himself? Why doesn't he come down and go, this is what God looks like. This is the way in which God would respond to suffering and injustice. This is the way God would respond to sick people and leprous people and blind people and poor people and prostitutes and sinners and tax collectors and anybody who wanted to know what God was like. Why hasn't God come down and said, well, I love you, this is what it looks like. Why didn't he do that? That's exactly what the Christian gospel is. It's exactly what the Christian gospel is. That God has done exactly that. He has appeared, he has come down, he has been God. He's come and said, this is what it looks like. He's come and said, before Abraham was, I am. He's come and lived out exactly what God would have looked like and said and done and thought and argued as a person on this planet. He's died as if to say, this is what love is. And then he's conquered death in his resurrection to say, and that's what it means for a new creation. So God is, that is exactly the difference between Christianity. You see, this is why Christianity for me does follow on so well from what we just said about a creator. You see, because the God of Islam and the gods of Hinduism and the gods of many other religious systems don't end up with a God who appears and says, this is what God looks like and this is what he feels about you and this is what to do about it. The God of Christianity, the God revealed in Jesus of Nazareth, has done exactly that.